This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. General Motors reported $1 billion in losses over the first 3 months of this year. Earlier this week, the company announced plans to close plants and cut 25,000 jobs over the next few years. With all those problems, you might be surprised to learn that GM is still the largest automaker in the world, but it faces tough competition from foreign competitors and declining market share, now less than 25%. Ford and Chrysler are no better off, and the business that used to define American industrial brawn is at a crossroads. The United Auto Workers Union worries about possible cuts in pensions and health care coverage, and all those job losses. Some argue that all Detroit needs is a hot new car that captures our imaginations and our wallets. Others describe the big three as corporate dinosaurs unable to keep up with more agile competitors, especially in emerging markets in places like China, India, and Thailand. Later in the program, Congress takes up the problem of underfunded pensions. But first, the future of America's auto industry. If you work in the car business, give us a call. What needs to change? If you're thinking about a new car, what do you like about American models and what don't you like? Does it really matter whether the car you drive is a Chevrolet made in Michigan or a Toyota made in Kentucky? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And to start us off, we turn to Chubb Achetta, the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. He's with us from his office in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Did GM's announcement this week really catch anybody by surprise?
Not at all. In fact, if anything, people might have expected a little bit more. This has been a very tough year for GM. After a lot of sustained loss in market share over the last 20 years, this year they're down another 2% or so from last year. They had a very ugly untangling of a financial arrangement with Fiat that required a $2 billion payment from GM to Fiat to get out of it. Their bonds were put into junk status by the various monitoring agencies, and it's a very, very tough time for the company. So I think everyone was expecting plant closings and layoffs.
But as you said, if they were expecting more, is this going to be enough to solve the problem?
Well, it's a good question, because the details on these plant closings and layoffs really haven't been disclosed. And GM announced 25,000 layoffs over the next several years, which seems like a lot. In fact, it isn't layoffs, it's a reduction in employment. Mm-hmm. And GM has been reducing employment about 8,000 workers a year over the last several years simply because of retirement. An awful lot of GM workers, like an awful lot of Americans, are baby boomers who've been working for 30, 35 years. They're getting to be retirement age, and there's a natural attrition that's going on. And GM can shed workers by simply letting workers retire and not replacing them. And it's not clear if this $25,000 worker reduction is any more than more of the same of that.
But all of those new retirees then still are involved in GM's health care and pension programs, and that is, at least GM says, another huge drag on the company.
Well, it certainly is a huge drag on the company. It is also a reason why the company just can't continue to shrink. When you're in a business like this, where not only does it take enormous investment to tool up and engineer and design new cars, but you have this enormous body of retirees that you have to pay for from a pension and medical care standpoint, you cannot continue to shrink, because if you do, your ratio of retirees to your present business keeps getting more unfavorable. In fact, that's one of GM's biggest problems. The company used to have about 50% of the market share in North America, mm-hmm. and now they have 25%, and the ratio of retirees to the current business is very unfavorable. Chrysler, on the other hand, because it was struggling in the 60s, actually had about 15% of the market share back then and has about 15% today. So it doesn't have nearly as large a body of retirees relative to the current business as GM does. Ford somewhere in between. So they all have this problem, but GM has it worse than either of the other two American makers.
That does not suggest, though, that Ford and Chrysler, that these are exactly sunny days for them.
No, they also are having some difficulties, although Chrysler is in relatively better shape, because they do have some hot models out there. the Chrysler 300 sedan, its Dodge Magnum station wagon version, and now there's a new Dodge Charger version, have been very hot. They're very good cars that are exciting. They look cool. They have performance. They have a lot of room inside. They feel high quality, and they're priced very well. And those cars are selling like hotcakes. They don't require any incentives, and Chrysler's making a lot of money on them, and consequently, they're in a little bit better shape than Ford and GM.
Now, if GM's problem is that declining market share, they need to find a way to sell more cars.
They do, and but it's not just selling more cars. They need to sell more cars and make money on them. I mean, even with GM's declining share, they sell an enormous number of cars, about 4.5 million cars and trucks last year. The problem is they're selling them currently with about $5,000 in incentive per car. And at that point, you don't make any money on them. What they really need to do are come up with cars and trucks that are best in class, that engage the public, and that encourage people to buy them without having to be bribed with these heavy incentives. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's exactly what the company needs to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to Chevys and Cadillacs, GM also owns Hummer, Saab, and Saturn. One of the big criticisms, though, of GM is that it has not been able to design a new car that, you know, captures the American market. I mean, they did very well with big SUVs, but those days seem to be over.
Well, the days are they're not so much over with big SUVs, but the market is shifting and also new competition comes in. All three of the American car makers made a lot of money in big SUVs and also big pickup trucks and medium-sized SUVs in the 90s. Americans decided they really liked those vehicles. The share of the market of those vehicles exploded, and the Americans were well-positioned to profit. Problem is capitalism works, and foreign car makers start looking at that, Toyota, Nissan, Honda, and they all jumped into that segment. Even Porsche and BMW are selling SUVs today. So not only is the market moving away from SUVs to some extent, the real issue is there's just a huge amount of competition, and the easy money has kind of gone in there. And the full-size pickups, which are, have been in the new millennium, the last vehicles in which Detroit could make pretty easy money, they're under assault. A year ago, Nissan introduced a full-size pickup called the Titan, and there is an upcoming new Toyota Tundra that will be manufactured in Texas that's also going to go after the big three dominance there. And when those profits go away, it's going to be very tough.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Let's begin with Brian. Brian's with us from Akron, Ohio.
How you doing?
All right.
Good. I was listening to the show, and I think, you know, you guys are bringing up some good points. I was actually in the business for a couple of years. I sold both domestic and imports at different times. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems with domestic manufacturers is they seem to have trouble making vehicles that are reliable, that have the reliability standards that that import manufacturers do, such as Honda, Toyota, Nissan.
That's certainly the perception, Chabachetta.
Well, that was certainly true in the past, although, you know, it is changing at this point. The latest J.D. Power initial quality findings just came out last month, and Lexus is number one, Jaguar two, BMW three, but then four and five are Buick and Cadillac. And also, the differences between the best brands and the poorest brands are a lot smaller than they once were. And it's awfully hard to say as a blanket statement today that domestic cars are much less reliable than Japanese cars anymore. I think part of the problem, though, is that cars are such a big investment that people really want convincing. And often you've got to have good reliability scores and a good reliability record for 4, 5, 6 years before the market turns around. It takes a long time for that perception to come up to the current reality.
Is it at all possible that some of the American manufacturers are too diverse as far as their, they have so many different model lines and so many different types of vehicles that they produce? Could they be stepping on their own toes even?
Well, to some extent that's true, and certainly that's a lot of discussion at GM now, whether they have too many models, too many divisions to actually be able to make money doing that. But, mm-hmm. you know, the reality is that these days, cars share platforms, which are the basic mechanical underpinnings
right.
of cars. And typically at each manufacturer, and this is not just a domestic situation. This is true with the imports as well. Underneath, there's a lot of commonality, even though the sheet metal may be very different. So the number of models isn't as great as you'd think, but everyone is consolidating, and GM's going to be doing it more. You know, recently they just consolidated product development worldwide so that, you know, they're not going to build a medium-sized car in America and a completely different medium-sized car in Europe. They're going to try and do that together to try and produce fewer models, and not only is there a cost savings, but as you point out, you can have better engineering and perhaps better quality that way.
Brian, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
The big three automakers from this country try to sell cars also around the world. Joining us now to talk about the demand for American cars in other countries and how those sales affect their bottom lines here is Michael Robinette, Vice President for CMS Worldwide, a global automotive research company. He's with us by phone from his office in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
Our Ford, GM, obviously Chrysler is Daimler Chrysler. It's already a foreign company to some degree, but are GM and Ford becoming more global?
They almost have to by default. You were certainly just talking about the issues that they're encountering in North America with legacy costs and the fact that the Asian OEMs are coming in at a more at a much faster pace into new segments. Many of the segments that the Fords and the GMs of the world have dominated. And then you look over to Europe, and quite frankly, the same thing's happening. The existing European manufacturers are under assault by the Asian manufacturers, and not just importing vehicles, but really manufacturing them locally. And that's really what the key is. So now the Fords and the GMs need to look abroad.
And are there emerging markets abroad? Are there possibilities, opportunities?
Oh, there certainly are, and you can see that GM has had a bit of a head start in China. They're doing some things in Thailand. They're also taking really strong looks at India, South Africa, also Central and Eastern Europe, which traditionally has not been a hotbed of sales, but now will be growing. This is where the incremental vehicle sales are going to be over the next decade in the emerging markets of this world.
And it's going to be tough also to compete against not only domestic manufacturers in those places, but also the same Asian manufacturers who also compete here.
Yeah, there is no doubt. And what you were discussing earlier about platform sharing, these Asian manufacturers have been using global platforms, and in other words, global underpinnings with modifications for different markets to make sure that consumers do attract to these vehicles. They've been doing this for 20 years, and we finally have Ford has been making the move in this respect, and GM is finally coming under more or less a global umbrella, something they probably should have done a while ago.
We're talking about the future of the U.S. auto industry, and we'll continue to take your calls when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the future of the American car industry. Our guests are Chubba Chetta, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine, and Michael Robinette, vice president of CMS Worldwide. Of course, you're invited to join us. You can call us, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jason. Jason's calling from St. Louis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for Chubba is, how responsible is U.S. management for its current problems? It seems that they've gone through the 1990s. They got fat and happy on the SUVs that they were selling, and suddenly they wake up, and Toyota, Nissan, and now Honda are all in the truck market, and suddenly they're surprised by this. And now it just seems like there's a crisis in the auto industry that they should have seen coming 5 years ago.
Well, I can't argue with you, and your comment is particularly pertinent to GM, because if you look at Ford's share in the 90s and Chrysler's share in the 90s, they actually both increased their share because of the market moving towards SUVs and big trucks. GM managed to lose share during that period, so they didn't even have the period of consolidation and very strong profits that Ford did. And that's purely management. There's no question. And GM, of course, there's been quite a bit of management turnover. In the early 90s, 91 or 92, Chairman Bob Stemple and President Lloyd Royce were actually fired because the company was performing so poorly. And there's been a lot of management turnover even throughout the 90s. And ultimately, that's where the blame has to be laid. There's no question about it.
Jason, thanks.
Well, thank you.
Here's an email from Mike in San Francisco. For those that look to a hot car to save Detroit, I think this is just wishful thinking. Look at the Ford Thunderbird, Mustang, and others. Sure, they're great-looking cars, but while these sell tens of thousands, new Hondas and Toyotas are selling hundreds of thousands. Bottom line, Honda and Toyota are competitively priced without rebates, and they have the first scheduled maintenance at 100,000 long after American cars have had multiple recalls. What I wonder is this: what's the compelling argument for why American car manufacturers will still be making cars in 20 years? Will auto manufacturing be any different than textiles, where almost all production and ownership is outside the U.S.? And if the U.S. does not make cars anymore, is this a bad thing? Chubba, let's begin with you on that.
Well, I would disagree with the caller's premise. You know, Ford's going to sell about 200,000 Mustangs this year. It's a serious number. It doesn't turn the company around, but it makes a goodly amount of money. Those Mustangs are selling without rebates, and they're very, very good cars, especially because they're a lot of value for the money. You can buy a 300-horsepower Mustang GT for $25,000. Similarly, the Chrysler 300 that I mentioned earlier is selling very well without rebates because it is very competitively priced. You can't come close to that car without spending $10,000 more with another manufacturer. So it absolutely can be done. It isn't easy, but if the manufacturers do that, Americans are more than happy to buy those cars. Now, if you go beyond that and you assume the worst and American car manufacturers continue a decline and go out of business, it's a terrible thing for this country. There's an awful lot of jobs wrapped up in auto manufacturing here, and even though foreign makers are coming more and more here to build cars, a lot of the critical design and engineering and high value added work is still done overseas, and it would be quite bad, I think, for America to lose that, lose those kind of jobs and that sort of expertise in the future.
Michael Robinette, though this can happen, talk to us for a moment about the example of Britain.
Well, certainly Britain lost its one of its last, I would characterize as major indigenous manufacturers when MG Rover more or less went out of business. There are some very, very small manufacturers of niche vehicles, but nothing really to take note of. Is it important that a country keeps their manufacturing base in the form of automotive manufacturing? I would characterize that, you know, there is a little bit of ego there, but also note that, you know, their resources could be better spent in other areas. Another country that I really could come under fire in this respect is Italy, with the decline of Fiat and the fact that, quite frankly, nobody else is really there manufacturing vehicles. The decline of Fiat affects Italy increasingly. You know, just a note on the caller's question: when you take a look at manufacturing in the United States, I also submit that we're not going to lose a significant amount of manufacturing in the United States, mainly because, quite frankly, inventory needs to be close to the final consumer. If you need to wait 2.5 months for a vehicle to come from Korea, and the right mix of vehicles are not coming over, you may move to another manufacturer. So there are a lot of other reasons why you manufacture vehicles locally, either in the U.S., Canada, or Mexico.
Let's get another caller on the line. Anne's with us from Whitehall, Pennsylvania.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about hybrid cars. It seems that foreign makers are making multiple hybrid models, and I have maxed out my GM rebate, and I'm almost considering not using it because I can't find a hybrid car in a GM.
Well, did Chubba Chetta, did Detroit get wrong-footed on this hybrid car?
Well, yes and no. You know, keep in mind that in this business, it still takes about 3 years or more to get a car to market. So as we sit here in 2005, car manufacturers have to place a bet on where fuel prices and consumer tastes are going to be in 2008. And they're placing billion-dollar bets, and once they put those bets on the table, they're cast in concrete. A few years ago, GM didn't think that, and most of the American makers, with the exception of Ford that has the Escape hybrid out there, didn't think that hybrids were going to be very strong. They didn't know where the price of fuel was going to go. And what they did know is that hybrids aren't very profitable. And I think at GM, where money was scarce even 3 years ago, they looked at putting that money into market segments where they could make a profit. Even to this day, Toyota, for all the success of the Prius, is perhaps maybe breaking even on Priuses. So from a business standpoint, I don't know that you can argue with what GM and Ford decided there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that they were expensive cars to make.
Well, they're very expensive. The biggest expense is the battery. a battery replacement in a Prius is $6,000 or $7,000, and it's very expensive even for the manufacturer. And you know, you pay more for a hybrid compared to a conventional car by $3,000 or $4,000, but in fact the manufacturing difference is even greater than that, and they're essentially being sold at a loss in most cases.
Is GM working on a hybrid at all now?
Oh, yeah. They've got a lot of hybrid technology, and they will have several hybrid cars out there in the 07, 08 model year. They actually have a hybrid pickup on the market right now. It doesn't get a huge fuel economy increase, but it has a 120-volt outlet on it. So if you're a carpenter, you can plug in your skill saw right into the bed.
That sounds cool.
Yep.
And thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's another email. This is from Betsy in Minneapolis. I work for the finance division of GM, and my dad and I solved all of GM's problems last night in the car, in fact. They need to dump Buick. Old people could buy Malibus and DeVilles. Consolidate Pontiac and Saturn. No need for two mid-price lines. Retire GMC. The trucks can all be Chevys. And find something to compete with the Chrysler 300. Damn, she writes, that's a great car. Don't tell my boss I said that. Michael Robinette, does that sound reasonable?
Easier said than done, as was mentioned earlier. The long range planning in this industry is very much a roll of the dice down the table. You really sometimes don't know, so that's why it's very important to more or less stick to the knitting. You know, does it make sense for GM to get rid of any particular divisions? I'd submit that looking at some of the demographics coming down the road, they're probably going to need a youth oriented division. Why not turn Pontiac into a youth oriented division? So you can go to your Pontiac, Buick, GMC dealer and more or less look at youth-oriented vehicles, a Pontiac, a middle-of-the-road, somewhat slightly luxurious cars, and some crossover utility vehicles from Buick, and let GMC be your sort of professional-grade full-frame truck line. You've got a lot of things that they need to be considered, and quite frankly, what does GM save by canceling a Pontiac or a Buick? I'd submit probably not an awful lot of money.
Well, what did they save when they canceled Oldsmobile?
Well, Oldsmobile was a little bit different. You had a lot of standalone dealers. Oldsmobile really was between sort of Pontiac and Buick in many respects and was kind of getting lost in the clutter. So what they've essentially are planning to do is move Saturn closer to almost where they wanted Oldsmobile to move. And so they are enabled to lose a division. But I think given the current structure, they can move forward.
Let's get another caller in. Mary. Mary's with us from Framingham, Massachusetts.
There. Great to talk to you. Great.
Thanks.
Subject matter. Something that I've been a little confused about as a consumer is when I hear that one manufacturer is actually the producer of a car under another name. For example, 20 years ago, the word was that the Chevy Nova was really a Toyota Corolla. You'd save some bucks and get a good buy if you bought it as a Nova. And now I understand, or at least it's my impression, that the Pontiac Vibe is actually made by Toyota Matrix. And I can accept that on the one hand, but then I wonder, they score differently in Consumer Reports. So are they the same car when you see something like that, or aren't they?
Chabachetta?
Well, the Vibe and the Matrix are, in fact, the same car. They're produced at the same factory. I think it's the NUMMI place up in Northern California.
No, correction. The Vibe is actually made in California, but the Matrix is made in Canada.
Ah, okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
The previous Nova Corolla situation was made in the same factory at NUMMI. And, those were the very, very same car. And there have been other examples of this. Mitsubishi Eclipse was the same car as the Eagle Talon and a Dodge version of it as well. This has gone on to some extent. Typically, there aren't too many common platforms that go across different manufacturers. But, different consumers have different expectations for the cars, and that's one of the reasons they get different quality surveys.
But I think what Mary's asking about is sometimes they seem to be awkward fits on that same chassis and do different score differently on safety tests.
Well, I don't think they score differently on safety tests because, they are the same vehicle. In the case of the Vibe and Matrix, with the exception of relatively minor sheet metal changes, they're the same machine. There's no way they're going to score differently on safety tests. But when you look at the J.D. Power numbers, that's a subjective survey. People go out and ask owners, what do you like and dislike about the car? And you and two of us on this show can get into the same car and end up with different likes and dislikes. And domestic buyers and import buyers sometimes have different priorities as well. And that's why you get sometimes the different quality results.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. A Pontiac buyer by just by tradition, will be happier with what will feel like an upgrade, and perhaps a Toyota buyer who's used to Toyota quality
a little bit less. That's exactly right. And in fact, sometimes there's been some domestic manufacturers, when they've gained market share and actually conquered some imports, which isn't very often but happens occasionally, sometimes the J.D. Power numbers go down because when you're a Chrysler and you pick up a bunch of Toyota customers, they're a lot pickier than your traditional Chrysler customers were.
I see. I think the very first caller hit it right on the head, though. It's a perception of reliability, and I know a lot of people feel that it's un-American to buy a foreign car, and I feel that it's actually American because somebody needs to hold our companies to task to improve their methods, as opposed to just complacently buying and replacing your American car every couple of years. You know, make our manufacturers build better by giving them competition. So I think in the long run, it's actually pro-American to do so.
Mary, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And Michael Robinette, we'd like to thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Michael Robinette is Vice President of CMS Worldwide. He was kind enough to join us by phone from his office in Farmington Hills in Michigan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Once upon a time, a job at GM, Ford, or Chrysler was a ticket to the middle class. It guaranteed a lifetime of work, great benefits, a comfortable retirement. Since 1980, these jobs have been disappearing. The remaining auto workers face an uncertain future and carry a heavy burden to support the tens of thousands who retired before them. Joining us now to talk about the union's perspective on GM and the U.S. auto industry is Al Benchich, the president of the United Auto Workers Local 909 in Warren, Michigan. He's with us by phone from his office at the local. Good of you to take the time to be with us today.
Good afternoon.
This morning in Detroit, you and all the presidents from the UAW locals representing GM workers around the country met with Richard Shoemaker, vice president of the UAW. What did he tell you?
Well, obviously, we got the information about discussions that have been ongoing with GM. As everyone knows, GM has been asking for relief on health care costs. And we are willing to work within the framework of the contract to do that.
Work within the frame? In other words, are you willing to accept the idea of cuts?
Well, there will probably be increased co-pays. GM has wanted some draconian method, has asked for some draconian cuts, which we just feel we're unable to accept. But we are willing to talk to them and work with them to try to come up with ways. We've already done a number of things in our last several contracts to try to reduce the cost of health care. We've out of our cost of living raises each quarter, there's a percentage of it that goes towards health care instead of going into the paycheck. We've instituted prescriptions by mail, which have been large cost saving.
Sure.
And there's other things the UAW has agreed to do that has saved money for GM, but as Richard Shoemaker said a number of times, it can't. The answer is not to change the cost, not change the cost, but to place the cost on the back of workers and take it off of GM. That's not the answer.
What was the mood at the meeting?
I think it was resigned. I mean, we understand that GM's in trouble. I mean, it's obvious financially, size-wise. GM is. We had over 450,000 hourly employees at one time back in the 70s, and today we're 112,000. Obviously, GM is not the corporation it once was, and we've recognized that fact, and we're trying to deal with that fact. But we understand that they're not in a position to do the things that they were at one time, and so we're working to try to make some changes that are palatable to our membership and acceptable to GM.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Shell. Shell's calling from Castro Valley in California.
Hi. Yeah, I was curious as to the negotiations as far as the pension matters were concerned. Is it tied to the company's productivity? If there's less demand for the product and there's less sales and less workers, is the pension going to also be less?
No, our pension it's a defined benefit based on years of service. And as of right now, our current contract provides that it's all dependent on years of service, and that's the way it will remain.
Not going to change.
I hope not. I want to retire in the next 2 years or 3 years.
Shell, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're going to continue with talking with Al Benchich and Chubba Chetta about the future of the American auto industry when we get back from a short break. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. And if, like Al Benchich, you're interested in that pension question, well, this is coming up before Congress now. There are a lot of American companies, and primarily, the airline industry is at the focus of this, having problem with underfunded pension programs. This could be a major problem as Congress seeks to address it. We're going to be talking about that as well. I'm Neil Conan. We're back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're continuing our conversation about the future of the U.S. auto industry. Our guests are Chubba Chetta, the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine, who's with us from his office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Al Benchich, president of UAW Local 909, represents the GM powertrain plant in Warren, Michigan, and he's with us from his office at the Local. Let's get another caller on the line. Bobby's with us. Bobby's calling from Hickory, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about styling of cars manufactured by the big three. With the exception of Chrysler, I look at so many American cars and think there's so much behind the cars that you see in Europe or other places that you might travel. And it just seems that there's not a lot of innovation in keeping up with new design styles. Like an example would be the GTO. The legendary car, but you look at the new GTO and it looks like a Grand Am from 1992. And I don't understand why the American cars seem to take a very dull approach to styling.
Chubba Chetta?
Well, it's a good point, and it's a very important point because styling is so critical in a number of ways. For one thing, it's the easiest way to make a car attractive. You know, to put a high-tech engine in often costs more money from the manufacturing sense. It really doesn't cost any more to stamp the sheet metal into an attractive shape than into a boring or ugly shape. So it's really critical to get it right. At the same time, you know, it's a little bit hit or miss. When you decide to step out of the box and do something wild, it could be a great success or it could fall flat on its face. And, you know, we've seen both from GM in the last several years. The Pontiac Aztec was an abject failure and roundly criticized for being totally ugly. Yet, in fact, it was a pretty adventurous move. At the same time, I think GM has got the Cadillac line in very good shape. Cadillac currently has a look all of its own. It doesn't copy the Japanese or the Europeans, and customers seem to like it. So it's very hard to consistently get innovative styling without occasionally making a big mistake.
Okay.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks.
Here's an email from Blake in San Diego. Michael Moore writes, got it right in Roger and Me, the docudrama. The rancor developed during the 1980s contraction has led to much ill will between management and the union that has extended to salaried individuals as well. This process of decline has its roots a generation ago, and it's coming to roost now. What do you think, Al Benchich?
Well, we, for a period of the last 20, 25 years, we have tried to foster a more cooperative approach with management, but that doesn't always work because there are many supervisors and managers that are threatened by it also because they have to give up power in order to work jointly and cooperatively. Before, where things were strictly done by management, they had total power. When you work in a cooperative team basis, it's supposed to be sharing of power, and so there's many managers that are threatened by it, and that's still the case. And I want to go back to the design thing.
Sure.
We have some fairly exciting vehicles coming out soon. One of the problems has been the design, which, you know, auto workers, we don't control that. We make the product, and I think one of the things that American public has to understand is that our quality is right up there with anyone's. In fact, GM has the top three plants in the North America in terms of quality, and we make a quality product, and that's what our part is. We build a quality product, and I think there's still a perception out there that our quality is not up to snuff. I would encourage people to check out GM products because, you know, we do build a quality product. The styling, yeah, there's still problems with the styling. The GTO was horrendous. But unfortunately, workers don't control that.
Al Benchich, let me just ask you one more question before we let you go, and that is, as you look at this, and I know you've thought about it, is this the end of an era?
It certainly seems that way. You know, out of the industrial age, we're the remnants of an industrial age where, as you said earlier, that created the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that in the decline of this middle class is has a downhill domino effect that others are affected by this decline. You have, for instance, there's 112,000 hourly workers, about 150,000, 170,000 GM workers total. But there's about a million U.S. jobs that are dependent on GM's existence. And the more we decline, the more it not trickles down. It's more than trickling down. Now, there's a lot of other jobs, other communities.
Yeah, snowballing might be more like it.
And so the more that, you know, and the promise was back in the 80s when industry started leaving this country, the promise was that, okay, we'll have high-tech jobs that'll replace industrial jobs, and that'll be the savior, that we'll have high-tech, good-paying high-tech jobs. Well, that hasn't translated into good-paying high-tech jobs. We see that being outsourced. Even the computer companies, the technological support is being done offshore.
Hmm.
And so it hasn't translated into the promised high-tech utopia that we were promised, unlike the industrial era where we did create a product and it created wealth and it created a middle class.
Al Benchich, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Al Benchich, president of UAW Local 909. He represents the GM powertrain plant in Warren, Michigan. And Chubba Chetta, we thank you also for your time today.
My pleasure.
He is the editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine. We'll talk more about pensions coming up.